And he did look. I'll give him that much. He met my gaze and held it. I ran out of excuses for you, buddy, I said. There's only so far one teammate can fake it for another, you know? In 7 months, Ray. Not once in 7 months. Not even at Christmas time. Not so much as peace on earth, goodwill toward lunatics. Ray closed his eyes. When he opened them again, tears spilled out, down his sagging gray cheeks.
I did the best I could for that kid, he said. For both of you. Let me out of here, please. Let me out.
Now I was crying. Now it was me sobbing in front of the whole friggin' world.
You were doing your best that night when you locked him in the coat closet, weren't you, Ray? That night she came downstairs with her arm wobbling at the wrong angle. That was quite a night, eh, Ray? Your conscience clear about that one, too?
He told me I could go to hell. Retreated through the living room, slam. The kitchen, slam. His car started, peeled out, jackrabbited down Hollyhock Avenue. I looked around the room, caught my breath, searched from face to bewildered face. Okay. Who wants more coffee? I said. Dessa stayed, helped me with the rest of the cleanup. Really, I kept telling her, you don't have to do this. She ignored me, of course. Whether she admitted it or not, Dessa could be as stubborn as her mother. But I was glad she stayed. I was grateful. I have to use the bathroom, she said. Then I have to go. I'm worried about you, she said. I told her I'd be okay, that in some ways Thomas's death felt like a reprieve, that I wasn't sorry I'd nailed Ray in front of witnesses. Well, you're bound to have all kinds of conflicting emotions right now, Dominic, she said. You really need to talk to someone. I told her I was way ahead of her, filled her in on Dr. Patel. She nodded, reached over and took my hand. If you want me to, I can drive you over to the cemetery sometime. Visit his grave, Ma's. Maybe visit the baby's grave, too, if you wanted to. She nodded, smiled the saddest smile I'd ever seen. She'd driven out to Angela's grave that morning, she said. She liked visiting her. She usually went there once or twice a week. Someone had just planted flowers for her, she said. Angie, maybe. Or her father, she'd forgotten to ask. Red and white tulips, she said. They were so beautiful, they had made her cry. I spent the next several weeks tying up loose ends on Thomas's stuff, checking in with Doc Patel, and watching too much baseball. The Red Sox, mostly. Bunch of bigger, hopeless cases than I was. In between innings, I was trying to figure out my future. Indecision was Hamlet's fatal flaw, Dominic, Doc Patel said one afternoon. Oh, man, I groaned. Don't tell me you have a Ph.D. in Shakespeare, too. Have you called the State Board of Education yet? Nope. Why not? I shrugged. In the session before, she had informed me that my shrugging in response to difficult questions was a hostile, not a helpful response, a passive-aggressive habit I should work on. Have you called Ray yet? Bingo. The $64,000 question. So I'd been avoiding Ray, not answering the messages he kept leaving on my machine. I couldn't clear the air with him, whether or not I had put it on my list of goals, whether or not he'd gone out there that morning of the funeral and planted those tulips for my mother, my brother, and my baby daughter. He'd been decorating Angela's grave all along, I'd found out. Almost 8 years. But I still couldn't forgive him. Couldn't let bygones be bygones, surrender to the statute of limitations. And anyway, how could I let Ray be my old man when I was still waiting for the real thing, still waiting for my real old man to show up and save the day? When do you think you'll be ready to take that step? She said. What is your deadline, please? I shrugged. At the doorway to her outer office, I thanked her, told her I'd see her on Friday, our standard adios. But the good doctor threw me a curveball. She was canceling our Friday appointment, she said. I should call her once I had accomplished the things on my list. She would look forward to speaking with me at that point. I stood there smiling, as embarrassed as I was pissed. What is this? Tough love or something? She said she supposed it was, wished me good luck, and closed the door. Doc Patel was right. I knew that. Grief or no grief, I had to get on with it. Call Ray. The third woman they referred me to at the State Department of Education was able to answer my questions about reinstatement. I'd need to take a refresher course, she said, and then take a test, and then have three classroom observations by a state-trained evaluator. Forget about it, I told myself. The writing's on the wall. You're a house painter. I'd call Ray the next day, I told myself. I'd already accomplished plenty. Somewhere in the middle of the night, I woke up thirsty, fumbled my way out to the kitchen for a glass of juice. The answering machine light was blinking red against the shiny surfaces of the toaster, the door of the microwave. Blink, blink, pause. Blink, blink, pause. I hadn't noticed it before. I hit play and stood there. The first caller was Joy. She was back on the East Coast. Was I at all interested in seeing the baby in person? If I was, I should give her a call. Maybe we could each drive halfway or something. She said her number slowly, then said it again. The second message was from a Dr. Azzi. Your father's surgeon, he said. The operation had gone well, no surprises. He'd amputated just a little above the knee, which was what he'd figured. He was sorry he had missed me at the hospital, but would be in touch the next morning. When he'd left the hospital at 8 o'clock that evening, my father was still groggy, but resting comfortably. Above the knee? Amputated? What the hell was he talking about? Dr. Azzi's answering service told me he wasn't to be called unless it was a medical emergency, but that he sometimes called in for his messages before he retired for the evening. The woman said she'd tell him I had called. Was that why Ray had left messages on my machine to call him? Was that what that limp had been about? And maybe I'd have known what was going on if I'd just had the decency to call him back. He'd planted tulips at Angela's grave. Bullied my brother and me our whole lives. I had humiliated him that day of Thomas's funeral. He'd busted my mother's arm. I lunged at the ringing. Hello? Dr. Azzi said he was sorry to be calling this early, but that schedule-wise he was looking at the day from hell. He was about to leave for the hospital. We could meet in the fourth-floor lounge in an hour. The red digital blur on the bureau said 6:11. Yeah, sure, I can be there. So, you had to amputate? You didn't want to fool around with gangrene, he said. He'd see me at about 7:15. I hung up, flopped back down on the bed, closed my burning eyes. Okay, I told myself, grab a shower, get over there. Fourth floor, right? When I swung my legs over and onto the floor, my feet crinkled paper. In the covers all around the bed lay the ruined pages of my grandfather's manuscript. I had finished Domenico's history somewhere in the middle of the night. Confessions, penance, family secrets. In a fit of frustration and freedom, I had gotten to the last page of Papa's history and wept, had yanked the pages from their binder, balled them up, ripped them, had made confetti of all my grandfather's excuses, his sorry excuse of a life. I stumbled toward the bathroom, my bare feet padding through the wasted pages. He died a failure, that much was clear. All that confession, all that 11th-hour contrition, too little, too late. Humble yourself, they'd told him his whole life, but he'd never quite gotten the hang of it. I showered, shampooed, stood there and let the water run over me. And when I finally stepped out, I faced myself, dripping wet and naked. "Don't be him, Dominic," I told my eyes. "Don't be him. Don't be him." "There's wet gangrene and dry gangrene," Dr. Azzi said. "Wet's worse, of course, because it means the bacteria set in, which was the case with your dad. That was why we had to amputate as soon as possible. If we'd let it go, the infection would have started galloping through him, shutting him down system by system." Dr. Azzi detailed what the next months would be like. Intensive therapy at the hospital for a week or so, then a transfer to a subacute rehab center, a nursing home, so that Ray could learn how to walk again. Then crutches for a while, an artificial leg later on if Ray chose to go that route. Some insurances covered prosthetics, some didn't. The goal, of course, was to get him back home again. Ray had made it clear to him that he didn't want to be stuck long-term in some convalescent home. "He lives alone, right?" At the end of our meeting, we stood, shook hands. "He's going to have a tough row to hoe, no doubt about it," Dr. Azzi said. "But he'll adapt. He was lucky, really. Remind him of that." I asked if I could see Ray. "Sure thing," he said, "but he had just had a shot. He'd probably be out for most of the morning. But I was welcome to go in and take a peek." I went down the hall, found Ray's room. I willed my eyes down from Ray's gray face to his rising and falling chest, then down to the bottom of the bed. My stomach lurched a little. I faced the flatness where his right leg was supposed to be, remembered my brother's shiny pink scar tissue, his grafted, upholstered stump. The woman who entered made me jump. She was chubby, Asian. We exchanged nods. Dr. Azzi said I could see him. I know it's not visiting.
That's fine, she said. Temp's down a little. His BP's good, she said. Are you his son?
I stood there, unable to answer her. When she lifted the sheet to check his dressing, my eyes jumped away.
I'll leave you guys alone then.
I stood there for a while, watching him sleep. Reached out. Reached toward his hand. Passed a finger over the hills and valleys his knuckles made. Like any other living thing, you starve something long enough, it dies. Dr. Azzi had been talking about Ray's leg, but he was more right than he realized. Thomas's drowning out at the falls had only been the official cause of death. He died down at Hatch, cut off from hope, from family. My brother had starved to death.
"I have to go because you suck all the oxygen out of the room," Dessa had told me that morning she left. "I have to breathe, Dominic."
I stood there touching Ray's hand and finally getting it. Dessa hadn't stopped loving me, caring about me, about us, but she'd needed to save herself, had needed to amputate me from her life because I was starving her, infecting her, because if she stayed, I would have begun shutting her down, system by system. "Well, good for you, Des," I thought. "I'm glad you got out alive." And my tears fell fast, splashing against Ray's bed railing, sinking into his sheets. I got home around noon, left a message for Dr. Patel that I needed to see her as soon as possible. Domenico's ruined manuscript was in there, lying all over the bedroom where I'd left it. "Okay," I told myself, "you finished it, and then you trashed it. So it's trash, right? Go in there and get rid of it." I grabbed a garbage bag and went into the bedroom. Stuffing page after ruined page of the old man's history into the plastic bag, I thought about Ma. She had been brave after all, brave enough to go on, to raise us as best she could. And earlier, the sober girl in those photographs,
standing next to her father in a starched pinafore, her fist to her face to cover her disfigured mouth. "Then I'm exactly where I was before I read the damn thing," I said.
"And where is that, my friend?" Dr. Patel said.
"Fucked up. Fatherless."
She said she begged to differ on a couple of counts. First of all, I was certainly not fatherless, provided I was willing to think beyond sperm and egg. If one defined one's father as the male elder who attended one's passage from childhood to adulthood, then my father was lying in a hospital bed over at Shanley Memorial, recovering from surgery. Whatever Ray's parental shortcomings had been, whatever trauma he had caused me and my brother, his presence in my life had been a constant. He had borne witness. Nor did she feel that the completion of my grandfather's history had left me exactly where I had been.
"Indulge the anthropologist in me, please, Dominic," she said. "Let's think for a moment of the manuscript not as a mystery with a maddeningly inconclusive ending, but as a parable. Parables instruct. One reaches the end of an allegory and confronts the lesson it offers. And so I ask you, what does your grandfather's story teach you?"
"That I should stop feeling so goddamned sinned against," I said. "That I have to let go of grudges."
She smiled, nodded, clapped.
"Is he finished yet?" the dietary aide asked me, a little huffy this time. She'd been in twice before to collect Ray's untouched lunch tray. At the nurse's station, they told me he'd woken up around 11 o'clock, been given another shot of morphine, and then drifted back to dreamland. "He's still out," I told the aide. "Go ahead, just take it." It was 3:30. Ray's eyes were open.
"Who are you?" he said.
I told him I was Dominic. Asked him how he was feeling.
"Who?"
"Dominic," I said. "Connie's son, one of the twins."
"Oh," he said. "Has Edna been here to see me?" he asked.
"Edna?" I said. "Who's Edna?"
"Edna," he said. "You know, my sister."
He shook his head, disgusted. "I don't know. I guess there probably is a god. There has to be." Dessa dangled the tea bag in and out of her cup, looked up at me. "He's not merciful, though. That's a crock. He's more into irony than mercy. He's a gotcha kind of god, a practical jokester. First my brother dies, then my stepfather loses an appendage, starts talking crazy. Stump 2, the sequel. It's perfect." Dessa said she was pretty sure that God dealt in challenges, not practical jokes. We were seated at a back table in the hospital cafeteria. An hour earlier, I'd held open the elevator door for hurrying footsteps that had turned out to be my ex-wife's. Now, with the exception of the white-haired woman at the cash register and a couple of whispering candy stripers two tables over, we had the place to ourselves. "And anyway," she said, "didn't they say he was probably just disoriented from the pain medication? Didn't you just tell me that you woke up disoriented after your surgery?" Neither of us said anything for a minute or so. I finished my coffee, began unraveling the styrofoam cup, apple peel style. "You still go to church?" I said. It was weird I was asking, she said. She hadn't been, had stayed away for years, but she'd just started going again. "Yeah? Why's that?" "Oh, I don't know," she said. "Because of this place, partly." When I'd run into her on the elevator, I'd assumed that something else was wrong with her mother. But Dessa had said no. She'd started volunteering in the children's hospice. "You should see some of these kids I'm working with, Dominic," she said now. "They're so sick, so brave. They all seem like miracles to me." "So what do you do for these kids?" Mostly she just held the kids, she said. That was probably the most useful thing she did. Kids this sick wanted physical closeness more than anything else. They just wanted to be held.
Did she want to go up, say hello to Ray?
She checked her watch. She'd like to, she said, but she was running late, meeting Dan for dinner. But okay, she'd just stop in and say hello. She couldn't stay, though. Riding the elevator back to the fourth floor, I realized that she'd just mentioned her boyfriend's name without me wanting to punch a wall. Progress of some kind, I figured. All that therapy had been good for something. When we got to Ray's room, he was sitting up, having himself a nurse-assisted sip of juice. "Brought you some company," I said.
"Hi, Ray," Dessa said. He stared at her blankly.
"You remember who this is?" I asked him.
He took another sip of his juice, gave us a grin so slight I almost missed it.
"Hot Lips Houlihan," he said. By the third day after his surgery, Ray was lucid again. His craziness had been caused by the painkillers, just like they'd said. 12 days after the amputation of his right leg, Ray was deemed steady enough on crutches to be transferred to a subacute rehabilitation center. Ray was sullen and quiet his first week or so, and what his social worker called semi-cooperative after that. At the end of a 2-week campaign to enlist him in her programs and special activities, the recreation director abandoned him as a project and let him stay in his room and sulk. "Your father's depressed," they told me. They said he sometimes cried in private in his room. It was to be expected. These things took time. I began visiting him almost every day, began taking his dirty laundry home after laundry services lost his favorite shirt. He didn't have that much. I had the time. By then I'd gone up to Hartford and taken that test for my teaching reinstatement, signed up for that refresher course you had to take. I still wasn't sure if I wanted to go back to the classroom, but I figured I'd get my ducks lined up, just in case. I had until the end of the summer before I'd become economically challenged. Sometimes schools needed teachers at the last minute. By then, Ray would be home and hopefully self-sufficient again. We watched baseball sometimes, Ray and me, played a little cribbage. Usually the TV did more talking than we did. One day he started complaining about the crummy shaves the orderlies gave him. They had to use electric razors. There was some kind of house rule about it. But an electric razor never shaved him right. "Shave yourself," I said. He told me he couldn't. His hands shook.
"Why don't you shave me?"
I resisted at first. Let it drop the first couple of times he mentioned it. But he kept it up. All right," I finally said, wheeling him into the cramped little bathroom adjacent to his room. "We'll try it." It felt weird that first time, unnatural, lathering him up, holding him by the chin and scraping the stubble off his neck, his slack cheeks. We'd never touched one another much in our family, Ray and me least of all. But I got used to it. After the first couple times, it didn't seem so strange. Probably more than anything else, it was shaving Ray that broke down the final barriers between us. Because getting shaved made him talkative, made him open up. I learned more about Ray during those shaves than I had ever known before. He'd lost both his father and his older brother in the influenza epidemic of 1918, the same year he was born. At least he'd been raised to believe they were his father and brother. When he was 10 years old, the woman Ray had always been told was his mother took sick with rheumatic fever. On her deathbed, she let out the truth, that she was really his grandmother, that his sister, Edna, had given birth to him. After, it was just the two of them, just Edna and him. They drifted from place to place. She'd meant well enough, he said. She wasn't a bad person, but she was weak.
Weak to temptation. In plain English, she was a tramp, I guess. And a drunk.
He'd gotten out as soon as he could, he said. Had quit school and joined the Navy. He'd only gone back to Youngstown once since then, and that was to bury her. December of 1945 it was. He remembered because he'd just gotten out of the Navy. Then after I got out of Korea, that was when the job with Fuller Brush came along. That was how I met your mother, of course. Lets me in over there at the house, and I start unpacking my samples, and all of a sudden she burst into tears. She had her hands full with you two. Both of you had earaches that first day I stopped in, I remember. You'd both been running her ragged. And, of course, she was all alone. She'd lost her father the year before, was just barely scraping by on what he had left her. I kind of felt sorry for her. She was in way over her head. Of course, I was kind of sweet on her, too. She had some nice curves to her, and that mouth of hers, that never bothered me. Just as kissable as anyone else's, I used to tell her. I knew right away she was a good woman. Plus, I kind of got a kick out of you kids. Double trouble, I used to call the two of you. You were both a couple of hellions.
His presence in your life has been a constant, I heard Doc Patel tell me. He has been there, born witness.
I know I made mistakes with you two, he said. With him especially. That day of the funeral there, afterwards back at the house, you weren't accusing me of anything that I hadn't already accused myself of. I hadn't grown up with a father, see? All I knew was that it was a tough world out there. I figured that was the one thing I could do for you two, toughen you up a little, so that you could take whatever sucker punches life was going to throw at you. Things get clearer when you're older, he said. Of course, by then it's too late. I'd finished shaving him, wheeled him out of his bathroom and over by the bed. I sat down next to him. It wasn't just you, I said. We were all a little screwed up, Ma included. She had her quirks like everyone else, he said, but she was a good woman. My heart thumped in my chest. I almost couldn't get it out. Almost couldn't ask it. Before, I said, when you said that neither of you were angels, did she ever tell you who he was, our father? We looked each other in the eye. I waited, not even breathing. My whole life rode on his answer. We never talked about that kind of stuff, he finally said. A kind of an unspoken deal, I guess. All that was water under the bridge. We just let the past lie, her and me.
Leo's racket scooped low for the shot. Thwack! The ball skidded up the back wall, arced high across the court, and grazed the front wall 6 inches from the floor.
"And I am," he shouted, "the king of racquetball!"
He just whipped me 3 in a row, something he'd never been able to do before. Soaked with sweat, out of breath, we headed for the rain room.
"Hey, birds!" Leo called over, mid-shampoo. "You got time for a beer?"
I told him I didn't, that I had to get dressed and get out of there.
"Yeah? What for? You got a hot date or something?"
I cut the water, grabbed my towel. "Hot date with Ray's social worker," I said. "We've got to go over his Medicare stuff." It was a lie. Joy had called out of the blue the night before. She was in Three Rivers visiting friends, she'd said. She wondered if she could come over and see me before she went back, just to say hello, show me the baby. I'd said no at first. What was the point? But she kept pushing. We hadn't seen each other in almost a year. There was so much that she wanted to tell me about. Joy promised she wouldn't stay long. A 15-minute visit, and she'd be on her way. We left the gym, headed toward our cars. I was easing out of the parking lot, stewing again about Joy's visit, when Leo tooted, motioning me to wait. I braked, rolled down my window. He pulled up beside me. "Hey, I heard something else today," he said. "I'm not supposed to say anything. Angie would kill me. It's about Dessa and Danny. They're splitting up." I just sat there nodding, unable to think. "It's not another woman or anything. It's one of those stay friends but go their separate ways deals. He wants to move back to Santa Fe and she wants to stay here." Driving home, I wondered why the news about Dessa wasn't elating me. I'd been waiting for years to hear what Leo had just said. For years. She wasn't going to come back to me. Life didn't work that way. You couldn't just pick up where you'd left off. For my own mental health, I might as well nip that little fantasy right in the bud. You see that, Doc? Aren't you proud of me? Joy was parked in front of the condo, already waiting for me, 15 minutes early. I drove right past her without even seeing her. I was out of the car halfway to the house when she called my name. Got out of this battle-scarred white Civic hatchback. She opened the back door, fiddled with the car seat, lifted the baby out and into her arms. Joy with a kid. If I wasn't standing there watching it with my own eyes. The two of them came toward me. Go away, I felt like shouting at her. Stay the fuck away from me. Joy was nervous, laughing, tearing up a little. She looked awful.
It's good to see you, Dominic, she said. This is Tiffany, she said.
Was Joy sick or something? The baby was already bigger than Angela. Well, older, too. My eyes bounced from the top of her head to her pierced ear to her little fingers. I couldn't look at her face on.
Same old place, Joy said when she walked in.
In baby talk, she told Tiffany that this was where Mommy used to live. Joy, who liked to talk dirty during sex, who'd come out with stuff that embarrassed me sometimes. Now she was talking baby talk. Had she had lunch yet? Did she want a sandwich? That would be great, she said. The baby needed to be changed. Could she use the couch?
Go ahead, I said. You don't have to ask first, God.
We ate at the kitchen table, the baby sitting between us in her yellow plastic seat. Whenever Joy talked baby talk to her, Tiffany broke out in a grin so sweet and pure you could have put it on baby food jars. She was beautiful, really. Like mother, like daughter. 6 weeks old, and she already knew how to flirt. I took a bite of my sandwich, checked the wall clock. If they were only staying for 15 minutes, Joy had better start eating. So? I said. She bullshitted me for a while about how great everything was. If everything was so perfect, why'd she look so bad? Why were her eyes so jumpy-looking? They stayed another half hour or so. After they drove away, I found Tiffany's pacifier. Her binky, Joy had called it. It was on the kitchen floor. When I went into the living room, I saw that she'd forgotten the changing blanket, too. It was folded up neatly on the arm of the couch. I picked it up, saw the envelope she'd hidden under it. Opened it like it was a letter bomb, which in a way, it was. It's 4 in the morning. Tiffany's still asleep. I have awful news. She hoped she was going to find the courage to tell me what she had to tell me in person, she wrote. She was putting it down on paper, in case she lost her nerve. She was HIV positive. She'd found out during her pregnancy, during what should have been one of the happiest times of her life. Thad's lifestyle had finally caught up with him, with both of them. The baby had been tested 3 times, twice out in California and once here up in New Hampshire. By some miracle, she seemed to be free of the virus. They're pretty sure anyway. She has to keep being tested up to her 18th month, then they'll be sure. But 3 different doctors have said they thought she'll be fine, that it would have shown up by now. She hung on to that, the possibility that she hadn't screwed up things for Tiffany. Some days, it was the only thing that had kept her from going off the deep end. Thad's never even seen her. Great father, huh? Almost as good as mine was. Tiffany and I were the only 2 people in the world that meant anything to her, she wrote. She loved me. She still loved me. You have to get tested, Dominic. I feel so ashamed. I'm sorrier than you'll ever know. I have absolutely no right in the world to ask you this, Dominic. But I don't have a choice. I'm desperate. I know I'm going to be too afraid to ask you this when I see you. if your HIV test is negative, if you don't have the virus, would you please, please, please consider taking Tiffany? Only if I get real sick, if it turns into AIDS. Maybe it will never even come to that. I have to know that Tiffany has a chance in life, Dominic. Maybe it's what God wants. He took your own little daughter away from you. Maybe he wants me to die so you can have my little girl. I let the letter fall, got to the bathroom, and gave up my lunch. I drove up to Farmington that Friday, paid my $20. They assigned me a confidential number, drew my blood. The woman at the window told me I had to let 3 business days pass and then call the lab at the end of the 3rd day. I couldn't eat, couldn't sleep, couldn't tell anyone. Leo would tell Angie, and she'd tell Dessa. What could Dr. Patel say that would make any difference? I visited Ray as usual, brought him his clean laundry, shaved him, chatted with him and his buddies. On Wednesday afternoon, I called the test center, got busy signals until 4:45. The woman had me repeat my number. "Okay, just a second," she said. I closed my eyes, gripped the receiver. I had it. I knew I did. I'd gotten the virus to pay for the sins I'd committed against my brother, my mother, my wife. The phone clunked. "Okay," she said. "It's here. Negative." I walked around the condo, took deep breaths, dropped to the floor and did push-ups. Go to some bar and get shit-faced, I told myself. Go celebrate life. I grabbed the keys, got in the car. It took me to the hospital. I passed sleeping children, fretting children, empty cribs. Dessa was in a room off to the left, seated in a rocker, holding and rocking a sprawled boy in feet pajamas, a big bruiser. "Hi," Dessa said. "What are you doing here?" I heard there were kids at this place that needed holding," I said. Dessa nodded. "This is Nikki," she said. "My leg's asleep. I could use a break." He had black hair, bushy eyebrows, huge brown eyes. "Hey, Nikki," I said. Reached down and took him from her, lifted him into my arms. In a lifetime of waiting for my real father to appear, I could not have imagined that I would find him in the exact same place, in the exact same booth, where 10 months earlier my brother had sat across from me and warned me that, should America launch into a holy war against the nation of Islam, God's vengeance would be swift and terrible. In the end, it was Ray who delivered me, Ray who took me finally into his arms and held me and brought me home to the man I had spent a lifetime looking for. "So how's it feel overall?" I asked him.
"Feels all right. It's chafing a little. I probably overdid it."
It was Ray's first foray into the world on his brand new leg. Things had gone well for a change, better than expected. We were at Friendly's having lunch, celebrating his new leg. "Well, they said they can make some minor adjustments after you've taken it for a couple of test runs," I reminded him. "Make sure you tell them about that chafing."
"Okay, Dad," he quipped.
Our waitress approached with menus. "Hi, guys. My name's Kristen. How are you two doing today?"
"None of your business," Ray said. He cracked a smile. He was feeling his oats.
"None of my business, huh? Okay, you old grouch. What can I get for you, then?" I recognized her. She'd been a fledgling that day when she'd waited on my brother and me, a trainee. Now, 10 months later, the Gulf War had been fought and filed away. My brother was dead, and Kristen here was an old pro at handling cranky customers. Kristen told us she and her boyfriend were going out after work to get candles, masking tape for the windows, junk food. She came from Minnesota, she said. This was her first hurricane. She was psyched. After she was out of earshot, Ray muttered that she wouldn't be so psyched if her roof blew off.
"Sure she would," I said. "She's young. She's got a landlord to worry about the roof.
All she's got to do is screw her boyfriend by candlelight and pass the potato chips.
Sounds like a good life, Ray said. What the hell are you and I doing wrong?
Our food came. Neither of us said too much more, and in the silence my mind drifted to the phone conversation I'd had that morning with Joy. I couldn't promise her something like that, I'd told her. She'd be all right. They were coming out with new drugs all the time. How about that AZT stuff I just read about? Had she heard about that?
I'd try to help her out as much as I could, I'd said. Help both of them out. But my own life was still up in the air. I couldn't commit to something as big as that. I just couldn't. She'd cried more than spoken during that conversation, had finally hung up in my face.
I've been thinking about something, Ray said. It's been bothering me.
Oh, yeah? I said. I took a sip of coffee. I thought we were talking about his leg.
Do you remember a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago about your father? How I said she never told me who he was?
I nodded, held my breath. He had had a similar kind of thing pulled on him, he said. The way his family had tricked him into thinking Edna was his sister instead of his mother. Our situations were different, of course, but similar in other ways.
What? What are you saying?
My heart raced. My breathing went shallow. Now that the moment was finally here, I was afraid to know.
I had promised her, you see, your mother. She only told me a couple of months before she passed away. I didn't know anything about it before then. Made me promise not to say anything. But I don't know. It's different now. There's money involved. She couldn't have seen that coming.
What was he talking about?
He died 4 or 5 months after you two were born. Never knew a thing about you. He got killed over in Korea. She read about it in the paper. That was how she found out he'd been killed. Never even knew anything about you two guys, she said.
But why? How come she...
He was a colored fellow. Well, pot colored, I guess. Heinz 57 varieties. Her father would have killed her, Dominic, you see? He probably would have disowned her. Of course, the funny thing is, he was the one who introduced them. Your mother and Henry. That was his name. Henry. Your grandfather knew his father.
They'd worked together at the mill, Ray said. After Henry's father died, Connie's father had more or less kept up with the family. Had sent the mother a little money from time to time because the kids were still young.
He worked at the store where they traded, you see? Henry. So she got to know him that way. Saw him every week when she did the shopping. That was how it started. Because her father had known his father. And because she saw him all the time at the store. They were just friends at first, for years. He used to sneak over to the house and visit her. Her father worked nights, you see. Then... I don't know. I guess one thing just led to another. They were human, same as everyone else.
Henry what?
Drink water.
I drove down to the reservation, past the bulldozers and cement mixers, the land that had been cleared and stumped, the coming casino. The tribe's new headquarters sat at the end of a rutted road, the beginning of the woods. An impressive three-story building made of cedar and glass. Brand new it was. Drilling and hammering echoed inside. I entered, asked an electrician if he knew where I could find Ralph Drinkwater.
Ralphie, yeah, sure, second floor all the way down. I think he's still there. That suite that looks right out onto the back.
He was hand-sanding a sheetrock seam. Lovingly, it looked like to me. I stood there undetected. And studied him. He'd sand a little, blow on it, pass his fingers across it, sand a little more. Ralph Drinkwater, tribal pipe keeper, the plaque on the door said. Ralph had been crapped on his whole life, had scrubbed toilets down at the psycho prison for a living, and had still managed to be a good man, to rise up out of the ashes. And now he'd arrived at this big, beautiful room, this big, brand new building. He'd come at long, long last,
into his own. "This going to be your office?" I said. He pivoted, spooked a little by my voice, stared at me for 3 or 4 seconds, more than was comfortable. The dust he'd raised from sanding gave him a frosted look.
"What can I do for you?" he said.
"I found something out this afternoon," I said.
"What's that?"
"That my father's name was Drinkwater." I watched the surprise flicker in his eyes, read his well-earned distrust. He nodded, leaned against the wall for a couple of seconds. Then he turned his back to me and faced his wall of glass, faced the woods.
"He had known all along we were cousins," he said. "He thought I'd known all along, too, that I'd wanted it kept a deep, dark secret."
"Well, I didn't," I said. "I've been in the dark until 2 o'clock today. I'm trying to figure it all out. And I need help, man. I need some help." My father and his father were brothers, he said. His Aunt Minnie had told him, way back before his sister died. Ralph had hated my brother and me when the four of us all went to River Street School, he said. Thomas and me, him and his sister. The first time he'd run across the word hypocrite, he said, he thought immediately of Thomas and me, the Bergey twins, who lived a lie. And later on, that morning when the two of us showed up on Del Week's work crew, man, he'd wanted to bust my head on that day, too. Mine and my brother's. He was as good as we were, as smart, if not smarter. But there we were, his big-shot white relatives, home from college and rubbing his face in how much further you could get in life if you lied about who you were, if you kept it a deep, dark secret. It had been our mother's secret, I told Ralph, not Thomas's and mine.
"Your brother knew," Ralph said. "How come he knew and you didn't?"
"He didn't know," I said. "She kept it from us both." But Ralph said he and Thomas had talked about it once during that summer on the work crew, that Thomas had brought it up, how they were cousins.
"I remember that conversation," he said. "He said your mother told him."
"He couldn't have known," I said. "She wouldn't have told him and not me." And as I said it, it came flying back at me, hit me right between the eyes. That day I'd finally sprung him out of Hatch. That trip we'd taken out to the falls. Thomas had stopped in front of Penny Ann Drinkwater's grave.
"Remember her?" he'd said. "We're cousins."
And I'd dismissed it as more of his crazy talk. But he'd known. She'd given Thomas his father, but had withheld him from me. Ralph and I talked for a few minutes more, me trying to take it all in, trying not to sink into the unfairness of it. Ma's same old fucking favoritism. "So, how do you become a Waquonic?" I said. "What do you do?" He studied my face for the truth. Then he walked over to a big plastic-shrouded desk parked in the middle of the massive room. He lifted the plastic, opened a drawer, and took something out of it.
"Here," he said, tossing something at me. "Catch."
I plucked it from the air and looked at it. A simple, smooth, round, gray rock.
"When a Waquonic baby's born, the women take the cord and form it into a circle, cinch it, so that it has no beginning or end. Then they burn it in thanks to the great creator."
I looked at him, waited.
"Waquonics pray to roundness," he said. "Wholeness, the cycles of the moon, the seasons. We thank the great creator for the new life and for the life it sprung from. The past and the future cinched together. The roundness of things."
I palmed the rock, squeezed it, released it, squeezed, released. "The roundness of things," I said.
"You want to know how to be Waquonic?" he said. "There. That's your first lesson."
There's more, of course. the coiled umbilical cord never really begins or ends. Hurricane Bob blew through Three Rivers and out to sea. In February of 1994, at the conclusion of a three-month trial, Dr. Richard Hume and four other physician administrators were cleared of charges of negligence related to the spread of AIDS and HIV at Hatch Forensic Institute. Hatch's 127 remaining inmates were transferred to Middletown, and the Forensic Hospital, the last operating facility of Three Rivers State Hospital, ceased to exist. Oddly enough, the abandoned state hospital grounds, once part of the sacred hunting and fishing lands of the Wakwanic Nation, may again revert to the tribe, annexed for the purpose of expansion. Tribal officials and the governor of Connecticut are deep in negotiations. Electric Boat, manufacturer of nuclear submarines, and for the second half of the 20th century, the economic backbone of the region, has in the post-Cold War era laid off workers to a small fraction of its former payroll. But if the defense industry has dwindled here in eastern Connecticut, the gaming industry has thrived. The Wakwanic Moon Casino and Resort opened in September of 92 and has exceeded by far even the most optimistic predictions about its impact on economic revival. The resort, which has both its champions and its detractors, employs 75,000. We 415 members of the Wakwanic Nation are millionaires. Dessa and I began dating again in the fall of 1993, although we'd been seeing each other regularly at the Children's Hospice. We kept it small and simple. Leo and Angie stood up for us, same as the first time. Ralph and I warmed to each other over time. We had, after all, a shared history, common blood. We had something else in common, too, which we talked about once. Both of us understood the singular loneliness of the solitary twin. My cousin, Ralph. Ray got used to his artificial leg without much of a problem, got home again to Hollyhock Avenue. He was doing great for a while there, had three or four good years, and then had a stroke. It was a bad one. Landed him back at the nursing home. The stroke paralyzed Ray's right side. He couldn't talk, couldn't walk without assistance, or swallow anything that hadn't been pureed into this puke-like consistency first. He's come part of the way back since then. We got him set up in a little three-room unit out at Father O'Keefe Boulevard, that elderly housing place the parish opened last year. I could have afforded more, but that was what he wanted. I check in on him just about every day, call him on the days I can't get there. He's happy enough. Joy died in March of 97. That was a tough one, draining for everyone, me and Dessa included. She'd put up a good battle. She and Dessa got to be friends during that last year or so. Dessa and Tiffany took to each other right from the start, long before she started living with us. We call her Rose now, instead of Tiffany. The adoption went through last January, a couple days after my birthday. Joy had signed all the paperwork a couple months before she died. She told me she'd finally gotten what she always wanted, for me to be that little girl's father. I stopped seeing Dr. Patel at about the time we took Rosie. During our last session together, I told her about the most recent of my Thomas dreams, those unconscious exchanges in which I fell asleep and became my brother. "I have a theory about those dreams," Dr. Patel said. "Shall I share it with you?" "Oh, yeah," I said, like I could stop you. "I think," she said, "that you may be attempting to incorporate in yourself what was good about your brother, his kindness, his gentleness. Perhaps you wish to be yourself and Thomas, which would be lovely, don't you think? Your strength and your brother's sweetness together?" I nodded, smiled. "You know what?" I said. I think I'm finished here.
I think you're finished, too, she said.
And we both teared up a little, hugged each other. I looked at that knee-high statue of hers standing over by the window, Dr. Patel's smiling, dancing Shiva. And I went over and snatched up that damn thing, grabbed Doc, and waltzed the three of us in circles around her office. We Waquonic Italians celebrate wholeness, the roundness of things. I was 41 years old, the year I lost my brother and found my father's, the one who had died years before and the one who'd been there all along. In the years since, I have become a wealthy man, a 6-year-old's father, and the husband, once again, of the woman I always loved but thought I had lost for good. Renovate your life, the old myths say, and the universe is yours. I teach American history now, at the Waquonic School, a different kind of history than Mr. Lopresto used to teach. My students balk at tests, complain that I give too much work, and learn, I like to think, what I have learned. That power, wrongly used, defeats the oppressor as well as the oppressed. I am not a smart man particularly, but one day, at long last, I stumbled from the dark woods of my own and my family's and my country's past, holding in my hands these truths, that love grows from the rich loam of forgiveness, that mongrels make the best dogs, that the evidence of God's existence lies in the roundness of things. This much, at least, I've figured out. I know this much is true.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.